Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, dare to be different. My name is Ismail Bia. It's just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's by the audio stream, medium wave, 1348 in Satellite Islam, and we are truly, truly blessed. Yesterday we had a sweltering day, intense heat, and even the evening was extremely hot, and temperatures went up to about 32. Today, looking out of the studios, Radio Islam, beautiful cloud cover, cloudy weather, and cooler. So, yes, definitely we are truly blessed. And when we look at the rains, we've had our fair rain this time. You know, though many people have predicted their names were only going to come, I beg your pardon, rains were only going to be coming in towards the end of summer, and, you know, once autumn had set in. But that did not happen. Whilst we are fortunate, we know that many other parts of the world, parts of the country are still gripped. With the devastation of the drought, and there are lots of people that are doing different things to help them. Operation Hydrate has been going around from place to place, province to province, and supplying people with this much needed, it's not just much needed, it's a necessity, and that is water. And we laud all those efforts that have been put into place to make sure that people are going to receive this precious, whilst we waste and open our taps, we find that many people are looking out and saying, if only we could save that amount of water, and we'd be using it definitely in different ways. So our heart goes out to all those people as well. And we have a wonderful guest in line with us, and that's Andrea. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, good morning.
Yes, Andrea, like I was saying, you know, we have many people still in the, you know, midst of a drought, and reading an article, it says that El Nino is losing its grip.
Yes, well, that's good news, I believe. But, you know, it's so cyclical. You've got the El Nino, and then you've got La Nina,
yes.
And the one makes it dry, and the other one makes it wet. So, yes, it's a bit like, you know, when you're a farmer, the weather's never... the saying is that the weather is never quite right. We just have to, you know, roll with the punches. That's how nature works, and we have to adapt accordingly.
Yeah, and while talking about that, you know, hearts go out to people who we find that, you know, waiting just for anyone to come along and say, look, here's some water, whilst in other parts of the country we find that taps are still running, and, you know, hose pipes and sprinklers are on, and you find this contrast, and it's very, very difficult to understand. And if you haven't been in that situation, you'll not be able to appreciate the water that you have.
I think we do tend to take water for granted. We are extremely fortunate in the modern age. I mean, you look back a few hundred years, how did people find water? They had to live beside a river. There would be no water purification. Cholera was rife. And nowadays we just open our taps and this wonderful clean drinkable water comes out of the taps. So we're inclined to take it for granted. We're inclined to think it's our right. And certainly to an extent it is with the capabilities of modern technology. But at the same time, we're still at the hands of nature, although we have somehow become one place removed from it.
And whilst we're looking at that, we laud there, you know, there's some beautiful efforts that are going up, and I know one particular one in our area is called Operation Hydrate, where they're going out and, you know, distributing water to areas that need it most, most distressed areas, and looking out what was happening over the weekend, they went to Modi Mall, the old days used to be called Nalstrom, and they were distributing water, you know, a couple of thousands of litres, and you found people waiting just for 5 liters of water, and that was a precious resource, and people couldn't understand that, you know, and that is why we find the anger sometimes being directed to the authorities saying, you haven't done enough. But those are some of the issues that we found coming to the fore, and again, to those of us who have this water, we should be using it, you know, sparingly, knowing that it is a precious resource. South Africa is a country that water is definitely a resource that has to be looked after.
Yes, indeed. We are a dry country. Some of the more northern countries, if you look at, for example, Europe, which is sopping wet. I mean, you just don't believe how wet it is there.
Definitely.
And there's lakes of water lying around and stuff. It's not like that in South Africa. And, of course, our dams infrastructure is quite old. And there's been a lot of silting up. And the reason why there's so much silting up is because of soil erosion. And the reason why there's soil erosion is because our plant cover is being destroyed. We have one of the largest soil erosion problems in the world. And that soil ultimately ends up in our dams, reducing their capacity.
Definitely. So whilst we're living in a country that's, you know, water distressed and soil erosion, we have lots of other challenges around that. And looking to the future, they do say that one of the biggest challenges for South Africa will be water, say, come 2020, and by that time dams are not built and the capacity is not increased. What we're seeing now will be sort of double or triple of the type of devastation that we have.
Yes, and of course another problem is invader plants. We do have a huge problem with invader plants in this country. A lot of people don't take it seriously enough. I've even known nature conservation student, well, hopefully by the time she graduated, she'd figured it out. She was devastated to see these big invasive blue gum trees being cut down in a watercourse. Well, they weren't cut down, they were ring barked, and it actually looked quite spectacular because they sort of dried out to these lovely, stunning white skeletons. And she said it looked like a graveyard, and she sat down and burst into tears. Very sensitive girl. But the fact of the matter is that those are very, very thirsty trees, and they were standing in one of our watercourses. And as soon as you get that kind of situation, obviously the watercourse is getting dried up. A little bit further up the slopes and so on in the catchment areas, there's also a huge problem with invasive plants. These plants are very clever at extracting water out of the soil. A lot of them are from Australia. They're able to extract plants in a way that our natural vegetation would never have done. They've taken over, and they are drinking literally thousands of liters of water a day, which is why I say that the work that is done by Working for Water, the fabulous organization, it helps to preserve our water resources while creating jobs at the same time and providing valuable skills to people. I believe that work is so, so important. When we don't understand the sheer scope of the problem, we're inclined to say a tree is a tree, one tree, a tree or several trees is better than no trees. Well, that depends on the environment you're in, depending on the species of tree that's there. We need to work with the balance of nature.
Thank you very much. And when you talk about the Australian blue gum, and that was brought in with the miners, you know, when they came in to prop up, and I think they've left this legacy wherever you go, and you find that definitely they're depleting our water resources. And like you said, it needs to be understood. And if all of us can just understand the role that invader plants play, while some of them are exotic, some of them do look beautiful, some of them have become part of our natural landscape, they have to be somehow or the other destroyed or found that they do not are propagated any longer. And, you know, I'm sorry, I beg your pardon. I was talking to someone and they said a guava was also an invader plant. Is that correct?
That is correct. The guava tree is an invader plant. But where I would like to advise people to be cautious, I would suggest that you find out in your at your local botanical garden, or if you speak to your local nature conservation authorities, as to whether a plant is a specific problem in your area. So, for example, we have so many different climatic zones in this country. Now, if you have a jacaranda tree in the Karoo, the chances of that plant escaping and getting into the local ecosystems and becoming a problem is very small, because the conditions are just not that favorable for it. If you are in Mpumalanga, it's a completely different story. So do remember, yes, we have declared invaders. We have plants that may not be commercially propagated, except under license for commercial purposes. And then there's a whole framework of rules in place there for the forestry guys, for example, with their pine and blue gum plantations, that they also then have to control the escaped plants out of that area. How effective that is debatable, but I do know that companies like Sappi and Mondi and so on are actually doing a lot of work on clearing invasive species and returning areas to their natural state, and controlling plants that have escaped from plantations. And in many cases, rather than nature conservation, it's actually these commercial companies who are managing to preserve some of our most beautiful natural areas, I think particularly here in Mpumalanga, where a lot of the beautiful natural areas are under the management of the paper companies, who are also, ironically, the people who initially created the problem there with their with their tree plantations. But looking after natural areas costs money, and it costs labor, So we cannot expect that all to come out of the taxpayer's pocket. So there's a lot of realities involved in there. If you suspect you have an invasive plant in your area, or you've heard that your plant is an invader, do consider removing it. The guava tree, for example, is a problem in certain areas of the country. So what you need to do is you need to discover if that plant is a problem in your area. And if so, obviously it needs to be eradicated. If it's not a problem in your area, please just simply don't propagate it and don't give little seedlings to people who are taking it to other parts of the country. There is a long list of things which may not be grown commercially in the horticulture industry, specifically because they're invasive. We're talking here about things like prickly pears and so on. And the reason why that is done is because we as human beings are very, very good at moving things from one place to another. So somebody might buy a plant in an area where it is not theoretically a problem, it's not invasive, and then move it to another province where it is indeed a problem. So, yeah, that's why these things are not allowed to be commercially propagated, a lot of them, except under license, with strict controls. Where do they get planted? What is the follow-up? And so on and so on. And we have some of the most advanced legislation in the world about this. And just thinking, we have the most, some of the most ambitious alien plant clearance projects. In the United States, for example, it's a huge problem with invasive plants and very limited work that's being done on it. I was involved in a conversation on LinkedIn with several American horticulturists talking about the problem of invader plants. And they're going, it's just impractical. The government cannot possibly control it. There are no programs in place. The occasional little NGO or something that's busy trying to do something. But they're saying we just need to accept this. And I feel that that is wrong. And if we in South Africa can do that, people in the rest of the world should be looking to us to see how we're doing it. And I mean, they're even making it economically viable. The trees that are cleared by organizations such as Working for Water, there's various uses for it. They're starting up little furniture factories. They're selling it as firewood. They're burning it into charcoal and selling it as charcoal. So there are so many different uses for these invasive timbers that get logged. And I think that needs to be borne in mind. That needs to be taken advantage of. It's happening in South Africa. I think in terms of world situation, we're actually quite exemplary. But that's not to say that we don't have a huge problem.
Thank you very much. Let's just go back to, you know, you've introduced us to some organization called Working for Water. Now, do they have a website that's active?
Indeed, they do. They are a semi-governmental organization. I believe they also, I stand corrected here, but I believe they also do some commercial work. So if you're a farmer and you've got a huge problem, you can get them in and they will help you. But their main mission is to keep our water courses open and to keep our catchment areas free of invader plants. And unfortunately, of course, there are limits to the funding that's available. Fantastic organization. They take people in impoverished communities where there's very few chances for employment. They train them up in the eradication and identification. Obviously, you have to know what it looks like before you can kill it, of invasive plants. And they go into areas and they take these very, very thirsty, which is one of the main problems of invasive plants. There's a load of problems, actually. They impoverish the soil. They suppress the natural vegetation. But among the other problems which we as human beings feel directly is the way in which they can actually dry up watercourses entirely. In my area, for example, there's a little stream that runs down from the top of the mountain down towards the lakes. And that stream is completely dry and has been for, the members of the Conservancy told me, 30 or 40 years. Before that, it was a strong, regular stream. It flowed all year. But there is a lot of pine, there's a lot of wattle all going down that slope, this blue gum. And these plants are drinking up the water, and that stream is completely dried up. Okay, it's just a little stream. But there are bigger examples of this, and we need to be aware of it.
Thank you very much. I think you've highlighted the importance of us understanding what invader plants do and how destructive they can be, and also that all whilst you do have an invader plant, to check within your area whether that is a problem, and if it's not, then to, you know, retain it, but not to propagate. I think that's the important thing, not to propagate it. Now, Andrea, we find that the challenge is, you know, and that's many of us go on holiday, and I think we spoke about this, and we see plants that are that look so beautiful out there, and sometimes not even aware of, you know, the disastrous consequences we have for moving them from one area to another. So, for example, if you've been in the Southern Cape, and you've come up on holiday and you saw all these beautiful plants, and sometimes you find people are dealing with them illegally. So those would be the plants that you would not want to buy, but yet you buy them, you come over and you bring them on, you propagate them into whichever part of the country you are in, and I think that's where the challenge is.
That is a huge challenge, and I have a specific anecdote about Hakea saligna, which is was used very widely as windbreaks around France for a long period, very fast-growing plant, very drought-tolerant, and very much appreciated at the time, until it was found that the roots really, really impoverished the soil. It's an invasive plant, and it ruins the soil. So you could sort of fence off your field with Hakea, and you were actually just giving yourself a recipe for disaster. Yes, it would block the wind for a few years, but after a while you'd start noticing that you need to use increasing amounts of synthetic fertilizers, and at a point it actually just becomes economically inviable to do this. And the problem that a lot of people have, and I've seen it a lot, is lantana, because lantana is absolutely beautiful. It's a pretty, pretty plant, but it's an absolute pain, and it's terrible in your area in particular. It takes over large areas. It's spiny, it's got an unpleasant smell, but it does have a beautiful flower. It's the ones that you see around you, sort of a compound flower, pink and white, with different sort of colors in it. Very, very pretty. And a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, it's just in my garden. It's not a problem. But the thing is that nobody tells a bird where it will take the seeds, shall we put this politely. and that's what the birds do. They come and they eat these berries from the plant. Homeowners sitting there going, wow, isn't that a lovely plant? Look how it's attracting the birds. It's got beautiful flowers. And then the birds go and distribute the seeds, shall we say, around natural areas and so on, which then later becomes a huge problem. And again, it's a very thirsty plant. And unfortunately, as compared to some of the other invasive trees, this is a shrub, it's a very, very soft, hollow stem. It's completely useless. There's not really much you can do with it. It's really a disaster in your specific area. I know I grew up there. And the lantana, a lot of people will have it in their gardens. They'll trim it into their hedge. Oh, it's got pretty flowers. But it's actually just a huge problem waiting to happen. And it might not happen in your yard. It might happen elsewhere.
Now, you know, we're speaking about invasive plants. This morning we have an understanding of all of, you know, how destructive it could be and how it does deplete our water resources and so forth. Now, was there a good watch point? How would I know? You know, if I'm a gardener and I'm sort of just starting out, I have lots of plants and I'm not really... I know these plants are growing in my garden. I don't have an idea of how to identify them. I don't have a clue about all of them. What is the best way to do it? Should we just continue doing what we are and forget about it, or should we become, how do we become proactive in this whole, how do we become proactive in to ensure that we're not part of, a group of people that would be propagating things that would be destructive later on?
Yes. Well, I would suggest in the first place, if you happen to know somebody who's got a good understanding of plants, to get them around your house and give them a nice cup of tea and ask them to walk around your garden and advise them. I've done it many, many a time.
Well, you'll have lots of cups of tea. Please do come over and we'll want you to advise lots of us.
But if you need to do this on your own, what you can also do is the Nature Conservation Authorities have been very proactive about spreading information about invasive plants. And what you can do is have a look at their websites and so on. They have got a lot of information up there about invasive plants. Another approach is to go and pick a little twig or a leaf or a flower from plants in your garden, pop down to your local garden center. Quite often you'll find that the horticulturists there will be willing to identify the plants that you found in your garden for free as a service to you. You say, what's this, what's that, what's this, what's that? I don't know what it is. Is it okay to have in my garden? And invariably, they will know what it is, and they'll be able to tell you, is it a problem, is it a nice ornamental plant? You've just moved into the area, you want to get to know your garden. Nothing to stop you from popping around your local garden center with a few little samples of plants. And I've done this, I will tell you, also many, many times for people. Sometimes they will look at the plant and say, I'm not sure, I'll need to see a flower or a seed. I can't just tell from the leaf. But very often they will even be able to tell you from the leaf, oh, that's this, that's that. oh, that's got pretty flowers, it's a nice plant, no problem. That's, and you know, it's good to know what the plants in your garden is. I mean, you know the names of your children. You know the names of your pets. So, you know, it makes sense to know the names of the plants in your garden and know what you're dealing with and how to look after it and whether it should be there or not. And you might find you've got something really exciting in your garden, you know, pop around and the local horticulturist going, wow, I haven't seen one of these for years. Fantastic plant. So, yeah, do that. It's worth a little outing, and it's a very interesting experience. Get them to write it down for you. What I used to do is I used to take a Koki pen, and on these leaf samples that I used to be given, I'd put a number, and then I'd write on a piece of paper next to the number, this is this plant, that is that plant. And the person would be able to go home and identify the plants in their own garden. So there's a lot of ways to do it.
Thank you very much for that. I think it's so important that we are able to identify plants that would be destructive in our environment, plants that are invasive, plants that are depleting our resources. I think that's important. And, you know, as we started our program, we said that one of the, whilst we live in a distressed, water distressed country, biggest problems is just soil erosion. We found that there's lots of soil, so there's built up of silt in our dams. And we all have to play an active role. All of us have to. And if we don't, eventually when you do find that the, you know, disaster does strike, it doesn't, you know, it's not going to say, well, fine, you have done your part, so I'm not going to have impact on you. You haven't done your part, I'm going to impact. It impacts on all of us. You know, it's not going to be discriminatory. It's going to impact on everyone. Is that correct?
It's inclusive. It's very inclusive. And, you know, one doesn't have to row with one's neighbors or so, but one can actually say, oh, I noticed you've got a lantana in your hedge. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but it's hugely problematic, noxious weed. I just thought perhaps you would like to know that there is something like that there. And, you don't have to be confrontational about it. Also, of course, while you're getting to know the plants in your garden, you also get to know what's beneficial and what belongs there. And what, although it might be exotic, is not invasive. At one point, the biodiversity bill was going to ban all exotic plants, which would have made life ridiculous. I mean, we would not have been able to have a peach tree in our garden without a permit. And that was just over the top.
And I do have to apologize. Sorry, man, we have to go for the news. When you come back, we'll continue.
We'll chat more.
Thanks a million.
Did you know that gardening is the fastest growing hobby in the world? Islam highly recommends planting trees and urges people to protect them to the extent that planting a tree is considered as an act of worship for which special prayer is recommended. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, unless you are compelled, do not cut down a tree. So join Ismail Bariava every Sunday between 8:30 and 9:30 a.m. on the program, Dare to Be Different.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, Dare to Be Different. My name is Ismail Bariava. Just wonderful to have you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming, Medium Wave 1548 in Satellite Islam. Many of you are still curled up in the comfy of your beds, others having breakfast, and more adventures would have been out in the garden. And we do appreciate everyone who is tuned in, and we welcome your, if you'd like to, any queries, any questions, remember the number to dial 854-1548, 854-1548. This morning we've got a wonderful guest, it's Andrea, and Andrea lives in the most beautiful part of the country, and she shared some wonderful information with regards to invasive plants. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Good morning to you.
Thank you very much, and I was just telling them, beautiful part of the country and beautiful part of the world. Tell us about the weather on your side. Has it been as challenging for you? Has it been extremely hot? We've had temperatures going up, you know, in our part of the world, which just hasn't happened for many, many years. And like you say, it's cyclic, but as far as I remember, I don't remember, you know, continuous temperatures for 35, 32, 33. You know, we sometimes get the odd days, but this has been continuous. Has the same thing happened in your part of the world?
Well, we did have a very hot, dry period. Although we do generally expect that here in January, February, that it's extremely hot and dry. And I will tell you the honest truth, I did not water my garden. The reason being that my plants can handle it. My lawn gets dry looking, but I'm using the indigenous grass, the buffalo grass. And what it does is it sort of curls up its leaves, and it looks like it's dead almost. But the moment that the rain comes, it livens up, unfurls its leaves, and it's lovely and green again. You know, the kikuyu, for example, that just it really does get patchy and bad when the weather's dry. But I'm very fortunate with that particular grass, in that it looks like it's really suffering. But as soon as the rain comes back, it flourishes. So my garden has not been at its best. I haven't been watering. My shrubs and my ground covers and so on are doing fine because I have chosen indigenous plants that they're ready for this. They know the season's going to come when there's not really going to be rain. I won't say they've been at their best, but they certainly haven't looked like they're suffering yet. So I've been very fortunate in that I have not really had to water my garden. I will admit I have given up on some of the more water-intensive things that I do in the rainy season. So, for example, those lovely flowering annuals, beautiful. I normally prefer to have them in the late winter, spring. The rain falls enough for them. They look magnificent. They help me realize that spring is coming. But here in the summer, I don't even try to put in new annuals because it's too hot. It's too dry. I will end up spending a lot of water on them. So I'm sort of also adapting with the seasons, not like the plants.
Well, Andrea, you know, you are one of the few that I know that have really gone out and trying to get your garden to adapt to the seasons. Many of us are trying to, you know, change things around and saying, well, fine, we'll do this and we'll do that because we want a beautiful garden. And you're saying you're quite satisfied and happy with the garden that you have. Tell us, why is that?
Well, you know, the thing is, it's all part of nature. Gardens should change with the season. In countries where they get very, very cold weather, the plant's dormancy is seen as winter interest. So, for example, a tree with no leaves on it, that's very sculptural sort of element in the garden. And as I say, with my garden, it doesn't really take that much strain because my plants are established. I have planted them during the rainy season, and I've been expecting it, certainly during the cooler weather, when if I do need to water, I don't need to water all that frequently. And then by the time the hot weather comes along, they can sort of cope with themselves. I've still got flowers in my garden. My crossberries are still flowering. I've got lovely foliage interest. I have got some of my succulents in full flower, and we should never forget succulents as a fantastic element in the garden, because just simply because they don't need that much water. There's one in particular which has a long Latin name, which I'm not even going to mention to you. But I mean, it makes these plate-sized, bright red clusters of flowers, right in the driest part of the year. So what I do is I try and plan my garden according to the season. In summer, I would like my hardier plants to be flowering. In winter and in spring, where I get my rainfall, there I allow my tenderer plants to grow and flower and flourish. But in the harshest time of the year, I am very water conscious. My vegetable garden, I also plan according to the season. But at the moment, I will tell you my veggie garden isn't as productive as it could be. But I'm getting geared up for seed sowing now. This is the time. If I germinate my seeds now, and I germinate them in the shade where they won't need a lot of water in little trays, I can plant them out very soon as the weather gets cooler. It's nearly March. So it's time, it's fine. Time to start getting prepared with those winter veggies. And at the moment, I'm also looking after my soil. I'm mulching it down, I'm composting. I'm getting ready for my next growing season, which is the winter growing season. And wherever you are in South Africa, there is a winter growing season. There are cool season plants, and I'm talking now particularly your seasonal plants, like your vegetables. There are cool season plants, but they won't thrive in the summer. They will hate it. They will get sick. They won't bear. Think about things like broccoli. Broccoli needs frost. You can have broccoli plants in summer. They will grow. They will not make broccoli. They need the cold. Brussels sprouts as well. They need frost. Most of your cabbage family prefers the colder weather. Your red lettuces, as opposed to your butter lettuces, need cooler weather. Peas hate the summer. They get powdery mildew and they're sick and they just don't really do. You just don't even try. So I'm getting ready for my winter gardening. My last tomatoes are in flower, and they're doing quite well. But I'm sort of going in my transition now from the warm season plants to the cold season plants.
Andre, we are now in the season that we always regard as an in-between season. We're coming and we're, you know, the tail end of summer, and we're now moving into autumn. And you've mentioned some very important things. Let's go to some of them. One is that, you know, succulents never do us down, and succulents can create a wow effect in the garden. I've seen some succulents and, you know, just standing all by themselves, and you have an individual one in a beautiful pot. It says so much to a person coming into your home. Is that correct?
Succulents are so interesting. There are so many leaf textures, so many leaf colors, and apart from the foliage, which is always interesting, you also get beautiful flowers, ranging from tiny little star-shaped flowers that just charm you, and like a little haze of misty little blooms over the succulent, to, as I said, stunning things that are these plate-sized inflorescences, which means basically a bunch of lots and lots of tiny little fluets. So, and a lot of them flower in this hot time of the year. A lot of people say, oh, you know, summer is very difficult for color. Yes, it is. But you can be a little bit clever. The indigenous sages, as I said, many of the succulents, not all, obviously, you can still have beautiful flowers at this time of the year without actually spending a lot of water on your garden.
Now, you know, besides succulents, we also have these beautiful foliage plants, you know, where they have different colors, you know, so we talk on the leaves and we find the textures, and while that happens a lot with succulents, we find different textures, but even with leaves we find that these foliage plants make such a beautiful display if it is used correctly.
Yes, I think a lot of people miss out on foliage color when they're designing their garden, and foliage texture. To me, that's almost more important than the flowers. Flowers are pretty, flowers are lovely, they liven things up, but the foliage is the actual backbone of everything. You get gray, you get silver grays, you get dark greens, you get light greens, you get lime greens, you get golds. And all of these can be put together into fantastic contrast. That's just color. Then you get texture. The most interesting fern-leaved little plants. Things with great big, yummy-looking tropical leaves. yummy looking.
Are you eating all of them, Andrea?
No, not all of them. Some of them are quite dangerous. But you get the feeling, you know, you get big leaves, you get small leaves, you get needle-like leaves, you get feathery leaves. And all of these things are part of a beautiful composition that you can put together in your very own garden.
Now, Andrea, we've spoken about, you know, the succulents. And again, I want to go back to these succulents. You find that some of them, you know, for example, the one that's called the mother-in-law's tongue, I found that there's been a trend in the last couple of years where offices are using lots of succulent plants. What do you think has been the reason for that?
Well, primarily it's air cleaning. I'm sure you've heard of sick building syndrome. Sick building syndrome is basically a situation in which the air in a building is not very healthy. There's air conditioning, there's a lot of dust, there's a lot of recirculation of contaminants, And people actually get ill in these circumstances. And researchers have found that there are certain plants that are just fantastic at cleaning indoor air. And the mother-in-law's tongue is one of them. And the other thing that's so incredible about it can tolerate quite dark conditions, a lot darker than most plants will. The most limiting factor with indoor plants is always light. There are a lot of things that you'll see and say will thrive indoors in good light. Now, what is good light? Good light is an area within about a meter of your window, preferably a north-facing window, that's getting lots of sunshine. Some will say filtered light, in which case they mean light for curtain or maybe a little bit further away from the window. But in general, a lot of your indoor plants need quite good light. Thinking, for example, of the bamboo palms, which are very, very popular, beautiful indoor plant, but you do need to grow it near a window. Otherwise, it's going to suffer. It needs that light, natural light, as opposed to artificial light. But then you get plants that I always call them, that throw them out the window, they'll still grow plants, that can tolerate extremely dark conditions. And among them is, for example, the aspidistra, also known as the cast iron plant. Very, very popular in flower arranging because it makes these big, beautiful dark green leaves. And the flowers are not spectacular, but the foliage is gorgeous and very, very long-lasting in flower arrangements. Very, very nice in the house as a house plant. Tolerates the extremely dark conditions, far from the window. And the mother-in-law's tongue is also another of these. Tolerates all sorts of things. It can take air conditioning. It can take dark conditions. I've got one in my own house that I actually dug out of my garden because I've got a lot growing under my trees. Quite naturally, nature allowed them to grow there. They occur naturally in my area. and I just dug out a couple of heads and I stuck them in a pot. And it's a very, very sculptural plant as well. It makes a statement. For those who don't know the mother-in-law's tongue, it has these elongated leaves, I'd say up until a meter or more tall when it mature. With different varieties, there's a green mottled with light green, which is the best for dark indoor conditions. And then there's also a green with a yellow variegation, which needs a little bit more light. As soon as you see variegation, you know that where that yellow area of the leaves is, not much chlorophyll. So the less chlorophyll the plant has, the less it can photosynthesize, the better the light it needs will be. So when you buy indoor plants, whether it's for decoration or whether because you also want to take advantage of the healthful aspects of it, do look into things, specifically the light. I think the light is one of the major ones. The other one is the watering. People tend to overwater indoor plants. And mother-in-law's tongue, one of the things I love about it is, I mean, my one, I water it every 2 or 3 weeks. And it's as happy as a lot. And I even worry that I might be watering too much, but it seems to be fine. So a very, very little water on that plant. However, if I had, for example, some other species of plant, it might be thirstier. But in general, I find that we tend to underwater our garden plants and overwater our pot plants. And vice versa, unfortunately. There are some of us who believe that pot plants should be able to live in the same way that plants live in the ground. And that's just definitely not the case. Plants and pots do need more frequent water. Then again, on the other hand, you get people who water their pot plants every single day. And although that might be necessary in the very hottest, driest, most unfavorable weather, in general, unless it's a plant that normally grows in a swamp, you wouldn't want to water it every day. So knowing the requirements of your plant are very, very important. Indoor plants, fantastic way to decorate your home, to bring a little bit of nature indoors. They can make a statement design-wise, especially if you have attractive pots and so on. Do look out about your drainage. Drainage is vital for indoor plants. Decide what's going to happen with the drainage. Water, you don't want overflowing plant sources in your house. This kind of thing. But in general, indoor plants, fantastic. I mean, I started my gardening career with indoor plants because that was just where I happened to get a job the first time. Oh. And I just fell in love with these plants. They were fantastic. They were beautiful. And they were quite challenging because of the varied requirements that they do have. But mother-in-law's tongue, fantastic air cleaner. Another one that does very well indoors, a lot of people wouldn't suspect it, is the speckworm, which we've discussed several times before, also known as the elephant's food. A succulent plant, again, one would think of it growing in full sun, but it can actually grow indoors. Although, again, here I would say in good light, so quite near a window. Indoor plants, fantastic way to clean the air and take away some of that shipbuilding syndrome that sort of builds up, particularly in offices, but also in homes.
Just occurred to one question that's come rather true. I have a house with my fig tree already, but it's starting to bud. When must I prune it?
Definitely not now. Wait until after it's borne fruit. If it's budding now, let it do its thing. Let it make figs. Sometimes you'll find with an edible fig that it will bloom and then not fruit during the first couple of years. Be patient if that happens. It does get around to it. But currently, I would say don't prune. No,
I think Andrea Solomon, I'm sorry about that. She says she's harvested the fig tree already, so it must have borne fruit, but it's starting to bud very early. When must I prune?
Oh, well, then in that case, I would suggest that she prunes it after lay, because she's not going to get another chance.
Okay, so, so what we're suggesting is that after she's harvested and now she sees the buds, it's best to prune it now.
Yes, I would say so. I would say so. If it needs pruning, then I would definitely prune it now. But do also assess the tree. Decide, do you have a lot of crossover branches? Do you have unhealthy looking growth? Do you have weak growth? Obviously, these are the things that you would definitely remove. Normally, edible figs don't grow a very dense canopy, so allowing admission of light is not really a major problem. But if they're troublesome branches, if they're weak branches, if they're branches that look like they're going to be a problem in the future, it might be a good idea to remove them now.
Thank you very much for that one. And I know we've spoken about this in the past. You know, Johannesburg City Council has been planting a certain plant for carbon emissions. Do you know the name of the plant?
Well, I think we might be even talking about the elephant's food because that is the ultimate carbon emissions plant.
Is that the one, the small brown leaves? That's the one that we're talking about. I'm not too
sure. Small round leaves, succulentish. It's got pinky purple stems, green leaves, and grows quite tall. I've got one in my tree, in my garden, that must be more than 2 meters tall. And I have seen one in the Lowveld that was really a proper tree. I was amazed. I've never seen one quite that big. But yes, they're beautiful plants, actually.
Okay, and then you spoke about seed sowing. Is this the right time to sow seed, or should we still wait for it to get cooler?
Well, in this time of the year, I would definitely sow my seed in shade, purely because your seed trays are going to dry out very quickly, given the weather. But if you want to get a head start on your autumn winter veggies, then now is the time for seeds. If you are one of the people who prefers to buy 6 packs or 12 packs or whatever you get and plant the veggies out, then you can still wait a few weeks, but at least until the weather is cooler. But if you want to get a head start on your winter veggies, this is a great time. I would suggest sowing the seeds in shade and guarding against drying out. And one of my favorite tricks there is to sow the seed in the tray, carefully sprinkle the soil over the seed. Remember, you only just want to cover the seed. So bigger seeds, it's very easy to see when you've actually got them covered. Just covered, not covered too deep. With smaller seeds, you have to exercise a bit of guesswork. With them, I prefer to use a cake sieve and some relatively dried out, but not completely dried out, potting medium, which I then sift through the cake sieve. This is obviously now going to become a garden cake sieve.
Definitely not part of the cookie one, not the one that you'll be baking with.
It might get a bit crunchy. Right? It's a great thing, you know, when you've got an old garden, old kitchen sieve that's starting to come away from the frame or whatever, turn it into a garden sieve, and then just very, very lightly use, if you can see the seeds, you can just... until it's just covered, and some seeds are so small you can't even see them, in which case you just sort of go...
It disappears many a time.
Sorry?
I say disappears many a time.
It disappears very, very quickly, and you just want to cover seeds. You don't want to plant them too deeply. Now, my other trick is to water from the bottom, which means that the soil is absolutely saturated. Without you having to hammer your seed tray with potentially small seeds, with a watering can, even one with a fine rose, is going to tend to float those seeds away from where you actually sowed them. So what I do here is I take a plastic kitchen bowl thing that I can rest the seed tray in. I fill it with water to a level which is slightly lower than the soil surface of my seed tray. And then I very slowly, this is the trick, very slowly lower the seed tray into this bowl of water. If at any point you see water bubbling up, if you see water starting to run around the surface, lift it again slightly and then start lowering it again. Let it stand there for a little while until you see the water should suck up with capillarity. That's the pores in the soil. That's why you fill it to a slightly lower level than the soil level, so that if you imagine the pores in the soil being like drinking straws, they're sort of sucking up the water gradually. Monitor the seed tray, because it can actually suck up quite a lot of water. You'll be amazed. And don't let water float around on the surface, because otherwise you're destroying the object of it. It doesn't take very long, a couple of minutes. And then very slowly again, because you don't want to lift out too fast. If you lift out too fast, the draining out water will also tend to make the soil run out of the bottom of your seed tray. Gently lift it out, and then cover it with an ordinary plastic shopping bag. I slip the little seed sowing tray inside a plastic shopping bag, and I tuck the edges of the shopping bag in. I leave it under a tree, and I monitor it every 2 or 3 days. You don't have to check every day. But when you see the seeds start emerging, it's very important to remove the plastic cover immediately, because the conditions that seeds use to germinate is completely different to the conditions once they start to grow. Now, obviously, you probably won't take your cover off if only 1 or 2 seeds have popped up. But when you start seeing lice in there in a big way, you need to uncover it so that you get less water. Because the whole thing with the plastic bag is you now have a self-watering closed system. As the water evaporates out of the tray, it condenses on the plastic and it gently drips back onto the tray. Lovely way of doing it, especially if you don't have a lot of time to check a seed tray several times a day to make sure that it hasn't dried out. Of course, the sensitive time happens when you remove this. Now your tray will need water more regularly, but at the same time, you also don't want to keep as sopping rich as you did while your seeds were germinating. I generally find that 1 bottom water is enough for most veg seeds. Sometimes too, and you would normally not have to do that again, in my case certainly not between 7 and 10 days. So you would actually give it 1 water to get the seeds germinating. and then uncover, so that you've got good air circulation and so that the seedlings can start to get natural light and so on. Otherwise they stretch and then they become weak. Looking for light which isn't there because you've covered the tray with a plastic bag. So that's my little big tip, and seriously, do try this at home. It works fantastically. You get much better germination out of your seed. So do be cautious how you sow. You can very easily sow way too much. And if you do, give it away as seedlings rather than planting it out in your garden and waiting for the produce to be way too much. Otherwise, you just end up in a garden that's lettuce, nothing else, or whatever the case may be.
Well, thank you very much, Andrea. Thank you for sharing that tip. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful tip. And we've come to the end of the program. And I know we've been chatting to you many, many more times during the course of the year. You take care. Enjoy the beautiful part of the country. I know you have it all to yourself now that most of the people from Gauteng are back home. So you're enjoying the rest of, you know, it's not the festive period, but rather the resting period now. Enjoy most of it. And you take care and everything best until we chat again.
Have a wonderful weekend.
You take care. Thanks, Andrea. Bye-bye. That was Andrea Durham talking to us about different aspects. And I like the last one where she spoke about how to germinate seeds. I think it's a fantastic idea. We should go out and try that. And also the idea that she spoke about, shrubs, succulents, and how, you know, the type of statement and why we should have some plants in our buildings, in our environment, so it clears the air. That's all from me. Until we meet again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.